So our next speaker this morning to end our morning on climate change and on, I think, probably a very positive note. We are really fortunate and privileged to have Paul Hawken with us. If I just mention the names of his books, you will get a sense of what he's been involved in for many, many years. He just told me that he started practicing Zen in Japan in when he was 22, which was just a few years ago. But he's long been a Zen practitioner and also a longtime environmentalist, about as long time as environmentalism goes back in this modern era. His books, The Next Economy, The Ecology of Commerce, in which he coined the term restorative economy, Natural Capitalism, Creating the Next Industrial Revolution. Natural capitalism, doesn't that sound like a contradiction in terms right away? And his most recent and really inspiring, uplifting book, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. That's the subtitle. Blessed Unrest. Please welcome Paul Hawken.
Good morning. I feel like I have to defend myself. Natural Capitalism was the name of an article written for Mother Jones first. No. The defense here is that it was about natural capital. And natural capital is all the resources and services that we get from nature that are not on the balance sheet, that we don't account for, that we don't monetize. And so the question in that article was, what would a system look like where natural capital had full value? And so when we were, Carrie, my editor, when we were thinking about what should we call this article, we didn't have a title. And I said, well, it's Mother Jones, let's really, you know, let's provoke people. And so we called it Natural Capitalism, and he was fired. It's a true story. And yeah, he's editor at UC Berkeley Magazine right now. And it produced an uproar because people thought it was a defense of capitalism in Mother Jones, and obviously they didn't read the article, they just read the title. So, yes, you do. You said corrected, and so. But I'm just saying it wasn't granola capitalism. It was actually the modifier was ism, not natural. And so I want to make that clear. Thank you, James, for where are you? I saw you. There you are. Thank you for having such prescience and insight and dedication to help create this center. Really, I mean, I think. It's a testament to all of us, you know, how small things can be so consequential. Many years later, even past the time when we may even avail ourselves of it or experience it. And it's a mantra all of us can carry, that there's really no inconsequential action, only consequential inaction right now. And so thank you for being so consequential to our lives. And thank you, Bob. This is the first time I've heard you give a Dharma talk. I've heard Bob talk many times. I had no idea. And I want to thank Mark for inviting me. And Mark and I share a passion for being outside and staying there if possible. And my passion for being outside came from a childhood where being inside wasn't safe. And you can figure that one out. And so outside was where heaven was, where joy was, where life was, where allies were. And so it's always been my my greatest teacher, really, being outside. The book, a couple of books that weren't mentioned, but one was Growing a Business, but the metaphor there wasn't to grow the business, but it was growing a business as a way to grow oneself. In other words, who are you? And so it's always been a metaphor. I heard a program, and Terry Gross once, and she was interviewing somebody, and a woman, I forget who she was, and she was saying that when she was a child that, you know, she would just tear off her clothes because she could feel the label, you know, the tag, you know, on her neck. And she said, you know, parents always put the clothes on. She was taking the clothes off. And she said it was called a high sensitivity autism. And I got out of the car and going, yes, finally I've been identified. I was going to the office, hey, now I know. It's like, I'm autistic. And I read a book, I don't know if you've read it, about this man who sees numbers as colors. And so I've always grown up, even though I write and speak, actually, I only think in pictures. I don't think in words. And it's always been a struggle for me, actually, to find words. So I work at it very hard, but I actually don't think that way. Actually, I think in pictures. So even when I'm speaking right now to you, I'm seeing pictures and translating them into words. And I mention that because of the slides I'm going to show, there's no words in them. and more like I think in some ways. And the reason I did these was because in my business, so to speak, which is the business of many of you here, certainly Joanne and Mark and Bob, and that is that it requires a constant immersion on a daily basis into information, which is actually quite distressing to read. And it's hard to know when to start the morning because you know when you begin it, it's going to be a digestive problem, you know, sort of spiritually and emotionally, you know, because you just keeps coming and coming and coming. And I find that what I have to do occasionally is really reframe it for myself, not for you. I wouldn't ever do that, but I have to keep reframing how I see things. Otherwise, then I'll see the world through my existing frame, and then I will measure or understand something in that context, and then I'll think this is right or this is wrong, which is, of course, such a dangerous place to be. So I find I constantly have to reframe and sort of throw away, wipe out everything that I think I know, and see things in a novel way. And so these slides are that. And what you'll see here is just a slide of where we are. And I have one question for you, because this question is what caused this slide to come about, or the next slide you see. And the question I want to ask you is, how big is humanity?
Not as big as it thinks.
Not as big as it thinks is one answer. When I say how big, let me give you a shape. How about a sphere? So if humanity was having a giant, you know, cuddle, spooning, and there's no airspace, it's a real cuddle, how big would we be? The diameter. Just guess. Don't worry. It'll be wrong.
10 miles.
A few inches. 10 miles. 100 miles, what? 100 miles. Yeah, across. Yeah, humanity, all 7.05 billion people. All of us, the whole shooting match, yeah, all of us. 100 miles, 20 miles, 10 miles, any more?
Half a mile.
Who said half a mile? Half a mile. A sphere, like a ball, like a, yeah. Huh? Oh yeah, no air, all squished together. Yeah. Really tight. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But it's interesting, we have a half a mile to 100 miles. I've gotten 1,000 miles, 500 miles in guesses to my audiences. So show the next slide. So I want you to know that that humanity, that sphere is there on that slide.
exactly where. Okay, go to the next slide. It's still there. Exactly. The next slide. Yep, there it is. I can see it. You see it? No, because you can't. It's so small. Here's the next slide. There it is. That's Spirit Rock right there. Okay, there's the next slide. See Spirit Rock? See the little driveway? And there's the parking lot. It's coming to the parking lot. There's where all the silent retreatants up there to the left of the bowl. Right? That's us. That's all 7.05 billion people. Okay, here's another one. There you go. Now, I showed this at Pratt & Whitney in Connecticut and other places. And after I showed this, they're all mostly engineers, and they came up to me and put their arm around me and said, "Nice presentation, nice graphics. Too bad you got the math wrong." And I can't tell you how many people have said, "Yeah, but you got the math wrong." You know? But it's so interesting that people who've never done the math assume that if someone who's done the math has got it wrong. And that's a classic example of how our framing dictates how we see the world and how we determine what is so and what isn't so, right? Because we have a frame already, and there's this like knee-jerk reaction like, "Oh, well, that couldn't be true." "Well, have you done the math?" "No, but that's not true," right? So far. So the next slide is the white thing. That's the CO2 that we emit on an annual basis on Earth.
How big was the sphere?
Oh, 935 meters. You were the one. You got the closest guess. Yeah. You did, yeah. 935 meters. And this is the 34 gigatons of carbon emitted every year. And when I gave this presentation in Toronto recently to 300 sort of executives, actually the reason I did this, and I had not done that before, was because they're in the C-suite, they're COOs and EOs and IOs and TOs and FOs and so forth. And so my question to them is, you know, you're business people, you have a bias for activity. Business actually is an optimistic act, you know, it depends on the future. And the question I asked them is like, okay, there's us and there's our carbon emissions per year. Now, you know, quite a bit of this carbon is sequestered in natural cycles, but the majority now is not. But nevertheless, I said, does this look doable to you? I was asked the question, does this look doable? I mean, come on, you know. And you can see by the scaling of this how relatively small it is on the whole of the Earth. There's other takeaways from this besides that, though. And the next slide, and this little beauty, that's the sphere of all the beetles in the world. And what I told them was, and you know, is the beetles are like, you know, breeding and pooping and eating and, you know, eating our houses and other things. But we're doing pretty well, you know, with them. The Earth is doing really well by them. And in fact, without them, we would not be doing so well, because actually their activity is an extraordinary contribution to, as a detritivore, for reprocessing, for digesting, you know, nutrient flows and changing them. And the question is, well, can we be as good as beetles? You know, I think so. I think we're not that stupid. I think we can, you know, we're not there yet, but, you know. And then the next slide just gives you a perspective, you know, and there's Spirit Rock again down there. And just so you can see what a, like, I mean, we're not even a hairball on Earth, you know, we're just a little speck. And again, the takeaway from this are multiple. One can say, well, how can so little have such a big impact, you know, which is certainly the question I would have. So those are the pictures. What I want to talk about today is really about reframing it in a different sense, not just in a visual sense, but I feel like that what we're seeing is that the literate, it's not the left, but a literate part of society who has read the sciences, avails themselves of the science, who understands the principles and the physics of the science, is going to despair and is catastrophizing the future. And with good data. It's very understandable and rational. And these are straight line linear projections based on the past and what we know. And then on the right, which is a political right, the left, this isn't the political left, but on the political right, you have people catastrophizing the future with no data whatsoever. It doesn't seem to bother them. But that have learned that fear is a very potent political weapon. But in both cases, fear is the dominant motive that's being put forth. You can say with all good intentions on the literate side, but, and I don't know what the intentions are on the right. I think there's some good intentions there too. I don't question that. But in either case, fear is being used as a way to try to, as a wedge into activity or into change or into votes or into money or into action. And I feel like 80% of the people are in between, so looking to one way and looking the other, and they might be leaning one way or the other, but in a sense, the answer to the activity that needs to be generated really falls in that 80%. It's not really on the edges. The edges perform a very important function, but it's in the middle. And the question is, how do we talk to each other there? And what we know from polling data is that for most people, that 80%, the way we have talked about it does not work, because it's been about catastrophization, it's been about fear, it's about guilt, about shame, about we screwed up, about, you know, we took the wrong road, about, it goes on and on and on. And furthermore, the metaphors we use, like greenhouse gases, don't work either. And it doesn't work for people who've been in greenhouses, and it doesn't work for people who've never been in a greenhouse. You know, they're just like, well, greenhouse, you know? So we need to understand a way, we need to talk to each other. And what people want is to feel more intelligent and more informed without a bias, without a sense of doom foreshadowing the knowledge that the information carries, you know. And this kind of activity doesn't really happen. And I think the only way we can communicate that way is if we fall in love, you know. We have to be in love to do that. And when we're in fear, our love is obscured, you know. And then we often then say, well, I'm very hopeful, but hopefulness oftentimes is simply another way to hide our fear. You know, it's just a way of hiding it, you know, and saying, I'll put it over here and I'm going to go on the hope side, you know, the ledger. I'm not talking about the way Joanna uses hope in her last book, by the way, but I'm just saying it's definitely, you know, another bias, if you will. And so I think what we have to understand is that if we're going to make this transition, there's several things we have to think about. One is this happening to us or for us? That preposition makes all the difference in the world. Because if it's happening to us, then we're victims, and then we're reactive, and then we have to do something, and we feel urgency, which is understandable. And we then do things that are a little bit Chicken Little-like, you know, in terms of our declarations of how we communicate, what we say. But if we understand that this is a for, like this is a pathway to transformation, a pathway to understanding, a pathway to community, a pathway to compassion, a pathway to embracing all of it, and see that this is the most perfect moment in history. It's perfect. Absolutely, exquisitely perfect. How else? What else could it be? And that we have come here, and our children, and their children, and have come at this extraordinary moment. James said, you know, it's in his introduction to Bob said that, you know, that
you know, I think there's a modified unprecedented, you know, almost no, almost there's almost no precedent or something like that. There is no precedent. I can be more emphatic. There's nothing like this. And so when we think about it as forest, then it just opens up all sorts of pathways, you know, of communication, of activity, of response, and it opens up joy and play and fun as well. Because really, when, you know, you think about it, when you were children, which sandbox did you go to, you know, where they were fighting and hitting each other, or the one where they were laughing? And so the 80%, if you will, roughly, they're going to go to where the joy is, where the passion is, where there's a sense of life internalized, not the idea that there's life out there, but people are lively and full of life, you know. And I mean, the solutions are so, to me, from my point of view, so complex and difficult, but on the other hand, so easily attained. Both are true at the same time. It's like, you know, there is no technical answer, and yet we can't do it without technology. Both are true, right? Both are true. Or we don't need technology. If a lot of us leave, then that's true. We can do it that way. But if we're going to stay here, if we're going to act in such a way that rather than seeing every child born as a new burden to the planet, but rather see every child as a gift to the planet and create a world in which that child is welcomed and honored and respected, and if she's a woman, safe, then that is a world that can absolutely address these issues. And the what I have noticed is that and I want to use the word unimaginable as a kind of a Rorschach, because if you look at the data from my point of view, and I think others would agree, if you actually look at the data, most of the climate scientists that I know are actually holding back. Because it produces too much of a shock to the system. There was a woman 2 years ago in Washington, D.C., who had just given birth to a child, and she was delivering a paper on ocean acidification, and in the middle of her talk, she just started to break down and weep. That's really what's going on. And the data she was presenting, and the fact that she was a mother, together just absolutely was overwhelming, you know. Overwhelming. But at the same time, I feel like the information that is there is so rich for us, because as James Hillman once said, you know, the gold is in the shadows, you know, and this is our shadow, you know, our collective shadow. And when I wrote Blessed Unrest, what I was trying to say observationally, not predictively or because I know, but what I was trying to say is that if you look at what we are doing collectively, there's this deep, deep wisdom manifest and being made manifest in the world. Extraordinary. And it is beyond comprehension of any one person in terms of its scale and its scope. And it's just, we just don't know. No one knows. No one tracks it. We tend to track things that are highly centralized. They would be corporations, you know, they would be Washington, D.C., you know, they would be, you know, armies, you know. We don't track what we consider to be marginal. And in nature, change always comes from the margins. It never comes from the center. You know. And so I'm so grateful that Bob and others are in Washington, D.C. And at the same time, I also feel like we have to be careful that we don't look for love in the wrong places, you know. You know, because it will never happen. And it's not to blame any person there or their intentions so much as it's the
it's and you know it because you're working with that. It's just, it just doesn't work. And I mean, you know that from reading the headlines, but it absolutely doesn't work. It works internally in some way that is bizarre, but when you look at it from the outside, it's not functional and it's not going to function. And so when we go back to looking at the margins, at this extraordinary collective wisdom that's becoming manifest on Earth, then I go back to these metaphors of nature, which are really that when you scrape or burn or cut, clear cut or poison or blow up any part of nature, any living system, within a nanosecond of that destruction, regeneration begins. It's the default mode of life. It's absolutely default mode, without exception. And what the pathology of self, which is just so hammered into us by the media, by advertisements, by who we honor and who we don't, who we extol and who we ignore, by our classrooms, by our teachers, but mostly by our businesses and corporations, that pathology, you know, keeps pushing us away from understanding that we are life. We are exactly the same as a coral reef or as a forest or as a prairie. And we, our default mode is regeneration. That's who we are. That is innately a human characteristic. And by being bathed in our perfidy and our unskillfulness and all the things we do where our shadow and bestial sides become manifest, we are separated from that knowledge which we have inside us. You know. So, you know, for me as an unenlightened person walking the earth, you know, the closest for me to awakening, and I say this with profound respect, isn't the stillness on the cushion, it's the stillness outside. And I definitely sit on a cushion, but what I'm saying is when I'm outside, and I think that's why Mark takes people outside and keeps them outside, there is an erasure and a dissolution of these artifices that separate us from knowing who we are in the profound way that Bob described in the Dharma principles, you know. Because it's just there. You know, it's not like we have to learn. And I took notes, but it's not something we really have to take notes of. We know this is us. This is who we are. That's what the Buddha was saying. You know. But what I feel like, in order to communicate that sense of love to others, I think we have to fall in love, or renew our commitment with the ring ceremony, with life itself. And what's happened is that carbon, the word carbon has become a sort of an adjective of like, whoa, carbon pollution is a word that you see all the time. No such thing as carbon pollution. Carbon is life. Carbon is the atom/molecule that is so friendly. It loves to hold hands and collaborate, which is why the majority of all compounds on Earth are carbon-based and why it is the basis of life. Carbon loves to play with everybody. And when we have to, rather than seeing carbon as a pollutant or even CO2 as a pollutant, I think the way in is to see carbon as our ally. It is our ally. Because if we're going to reconfigure this relationship we have with living systems, this is a human system, okay, that little ball, but we have this relationship with living systems, we're a living system ourselves. But those dynamics are, of course, you know, producing conditions that are inimical to life, inimical to civilization, you know, not going to help us moving forward, because they will cause great suffering and great losses, you know. So if we're going to do that, I think rather than become more determined and fixed in our senses about carbon being this or this or that, I think we have to reacquaint ourselves with what carbon is. Malcolm Margolin this morning, at Heyday, published a book by Bernie Krause. And Bernie and some others developed a field of acoustic ecology, and it's a very fascinating field. And basically what it says is that when you have an intact ecosystem, that not only do the creatures in that ecosystem fill out the niches in terms of nutrient flow, you know, and all get in there so that, you know, you have this amazingly complex, beautiful system, but they also fill out the acoustic niches as well. So that when you do an sonoscope, when you do a soundgram, you know, when you do it, you actually find that, you know, the beetles and the insects and the birds and the frogs and whoever, you know, will have filled out all the acoustic niches. Okay. Now, if you build a bridge, you know, across the swamp or the wetland, and that bridge is a, you know, it's the I-5 or whatever, and it's like, you know, 24/7, what happens is that it starts to populate part of the acoustics, you know. And those critters and creatures who populated it then die off. And once they die off, as you know, because it's such a complex system, the system goes into perturbation and other creatures start to die off as well. So in other words, you haven't done anything to the system itself, but you've done something to the sound that one of the creatures occupied. And then when that happens, you get a release of carbon into the atmosphere. Whereas when it's intact, you get a system that maintains and sequesters the maximum amount of carbon there is. So even in these subtle, beautiful, intricate ways, you know, we can start to see our relationship and the carbon, but not only our relationship, but the relationship of the 2 million creatures that we have identified so far that work in such extraordinary ways and mimic carbon in the sense of they're so collaborative. And the Darwinian misquote that's been bandied about forever really has given away to a sense of this fantastic mutualism that we see in nature. It's so beautiful. And it's not an eye for an eye and tooth for tooth and all that sort of stuff. You know, survival of the fittest. It's just not true, you know. And in the same sense, if we look at our actions, like, you know, when the conquest happened in, you know, the early 1500s, and the Spanish and the Portuguese came to North and Meso and South America, the population at that time was estimated to be 110 million people on the three continents. And within 100 years, there was only 10 million people left. Disease, it really wasn't weapons so much. Actually, the first peoples actually won all the battles. It was disease, you know, that won. And you've read, probably know of gun germs and steel. But what happened then is that this was the most developed agricultural continents in the world. Much more developed in Europe, and the exception would be China, which was equally developed. Okay, but certainly it was extremely well developed. And what happened is, with the die-off of people, the fields went fallow, and they went back in the South America, Mesoamerica, they went back to bamboo. And bamboo sequesters carbon so quickly because it grows so fast. And carbon actually went down in the atmosphere. And then the beginning of 1745, then you had it's called the Maunder Minimum. You had this, you know, ice age, you know, 1645 to 1715. So you had the Maunder Minimum, and temperatures plummeted all over the world. The climate changed. And there was famine and starvation in Europe. And during that time, the trees that grew in Sweden
had very, very, very tight rings, the birch and the maple and the spruce. And there are people who say that the reason Stradivarius violins and cellos are so extraordinary is because he harvested wood that was right after the modern minimum, where the trees had this density, and no wood has ever been made since then. So again, you get this amazing, the conquest was not beautiful, and the genocide, I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying is when you start to look at our relationship to carbon, you find that it isn't this sort of boring thing you got in, sixth grade of, the oceans and, the atmosphere and the forest and the atmospheres and the soil. That's like saying, what is humanity? Well, people get born and have children and then they die. I mean, that isn't humanity. But that's what we are exposed to when we talk about carbon cycles. Even to talk about it as a cycle, in a sense, is so diminishing to the complexity and the beauty of carbon. And I feel like what we need to do is bring people into the sense of life again. And that's the conversation we need to have. And in that context, and in that appreciation and wonder and awe of life, which is, equals carbon, so forth, then they can hear the news, the bad news, the disturbing news, the upsetting news, the news that does not fit our frame of what ought to happen or what we would like to happen, but what is true. And they can handle it in such a different way than if they're hammered with it, if they're hit with it. And so it may seem, circumlocutious in a way to go that way as opposed right to the data, but I actually feel very strongly that what people need, and I see, things like Boston and Newton, what we're lacking is the experience that people can have in this culture, this American culture, of being loved. And the way to people to feel being loved is to love, and you can love anything, music and food or any aspect of this, but I don't say this to, because Malcolm is there, but the reason Malcolm, I've always been one of my favorite speakers, is not because he's the best storyteller I know, which he is, but because his stories emanate this great sense of affection and love for what he's talking about. You can tell a good story, but, it's just stories. Without that, he brings the stories to life, and we all need to become storytellers. I was just told I have 5 minutes, but actually Mark said I have more than that. So you guys want to talk? And I want to 10. Yeah, not a lot more, but I really appreciate that. Maybe 15, okay. But what I'd like to do, though, is open up now to your comments or questions and hear from you. And there's a hand right here. Yes.
About maybe 4 years ago, I heard you speak at Commonweal in Salinas. I'm not sure what the subject was.
Me neither.
Someone asked you what we should do to get ready for what happens when the shit hits the fan. And I was really struck by your response. Is this on? And what you said was, community is the most important thing. And I would love to hear you expand on that.
Thank you. What she said was that 4 years ago, she heard me speak at Commonweal, and somebody asked what to do when the shift hits the fan. And I said the most important thing is community. Well, community in all living systems is the most effective way organisms can live in terms of their interaction, in terms of nutrient flows, in terms of energetics. So, and again, we're no different. And there was, I know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, there was this idea that, you go out to the country and 5 acres and a rototiller, and that was the best way to do it. And it really isn't. I mean, that's fine too, but it isn't. That's not for everybody. This is the best way. And what I meant at that time was that as a practice in resilience, we have to localize everything, and maybe not coffee or cinnamon, but just as much as possible. We have to localize, so it's not just our food networks, but it's energy networks, and that's what I've been working on for the last 4 years, is how to create a solar panel that costs $18 or $19 to make and can be made locally and is 90% recycled materials, is based on biomimicry and green chemistry, and is non-toxic. But it's a way of localizing energy generation as opposed to buying panels from China. So I feel like when communities come together in the post-carbon movement and post-carbon initiatives are great this way in trying to rethink the patterns and the systems, you know, again, that Bob was talking about, that we take for granted and yet that I think are vulnerable going forward. They're vulnerable to changes in resource availability and to costs, you know, to the price. And so, but also it's such an edifying activity because, you know, you meet your neighbor and you work together and you have a shared goals and there's conviviality and it makes us more human.
So one of the things that I'm hearing a lot of us think about or talk about is the difference between content and process. And it seems to me that from the book that you wrote, the last one, that a lot of what you probably observed was the differences in the way that people interact with each other in the process, whether it's decision-making or problem-solving. You know, and I'm thinking of the Occupy movement and how they really have been a kind of a bellwether in some ways of distributed networks. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to hear you talk about what you're observing about the differences in the way that people are approaching process.
Well, the book Blessed Unrest arose in 1999 at the WTO protests in Seattle. And I was there simply as a protester, activist. I wasn't there as a writer. In fact, I took no notes at all. But what I noticed was that the way it was organized is different because my background goes back to civil rights and in the South and the anti-war movement and so on. So I was struck that it did not have a top-down hierarchical, you know, charismatic white male vertebrate structure. And I thought, well, this is cool. And it was the frustration of the Seattle Police and the Cook County Sheriff's Department because they couldn't find the center. They couldn't cut off, they couldn't decapitate it because it didn't have a caput, you know. And so, and then when I got back home, and two things I noticed. One is that everything that was written about it was just complete malarkey. You know, Tom Friedman, everybody, they were in New York and, you know, writing, telling us what happened there. Either that or they were hiding in the Four Seasons and wouldn't go outside. And so I wrote a long piece about it. But the thing that I tried to find was, well, how was it organized? And the organization went back to the encuentros that were in 1990 and 1992, which were the first time when the first peoples of the three Americas got together since the conquest. And they used the organizational principles they used were Mayan-based. And these organizational methods were used in Seattle. And I'm going, huh? How? What? Who? Where is the transmission? Where was there a class in this? You know, did I miss it? And I began to get a sense of a connected movement, which, you know, in 99, this is 2013, I mean, but the connectivity has increased just fantastically. But so to me, the process now is beyond my ken completely. The intelligence, the brilliance with which the youth are organizing themselves and acting and functioning worldwide is just astonishing. It's one of those, you know, fish walking out of water kind of things that we're seeing right now that was entirely unpredicted, and that we're still on the crest of it. We don't even, I mean, just the threshold, we don't even know where it's going to be in 5 years or 10 years. So
I see the ability, and I see that in LGBT issues and so forth. I mean, 2010, I know this is my last answer, so Eva, don't worry. The gay marriage was a huge wedge issue in the congressional elections, you know, and people who used it won. I mean, it was like, whoa, whoa, you know. And 2013, those same people are running as fast as they can the other way with their tail behind their legs saying, oh, okay, it's okay, I'm okay with it, you know. I'm not going to vote against it, you know. And what happened is my question. You know, what happened? I don't think we'll ever know, actually, but something happened. And there was a widespread shift in this country. And I give credit to hundreds of thousands of activists, you know, who just were relentless, you know, not in your face, but would not ever let go. And I also give credit to a new generation coming up and saying, what's the problem? I don't get it. Right? And the two combined, you know, produced this, you know, capitulation by the Republicans and some Democrats as well who were opposed to it. So I see, when I said unimaginable, what is really unimaginable right now is that we're going to prevail in this thing. That's what we can't imagine. And when you use that word, and so we use it as a way to talk about what the scientists are telling us, you know, it's like, oh my God, who could have imagined? But I think what's truly unimaginable for us and what we should try to imagine is that humanity has this deep, deep, compelling wisdom, you know, that's coming to the fore. And it doesn't mean we can watch it. That's us. It means we have to act as well. But that action, when it's based on the practices that Bob described, you know, is more effective than I think we give ourselves credit for, you know, in this. Anyway, so thank you very much for your question.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.